This is the arms race and human rights from a Soviet perspective. If you're not in the right place, you might want to go now. My name is Bill Chadwick. What I want to do first is give you a couple of handouts. I was going to run this one sheet off, arms control and disarmament agreements, but I asked where the copy machine was, and they said in Wenatchee, so I didn't. Copy of the recent revised constitution of the Union of Soviet Republics from 1978. Does anybody know? That's a trivia question for you. I feel like I'm a long ways away, but I like to use the mic. How many of you were not at yesterday's session? Oh, a good number of you. Okay. Not interested in the church, but you are interested in the arms race. Okay. Or else they only came today. Okay. Good. Yeah, we will. And then let me do a little background. I was privileged to be a part of 266 American Christians to visit the Soviet Union for 2 weeks in June of this year. It's part of an ongoing exchange of Christians between the two countries dating back to 1956. In this country, it is under the auspices of the National Council of Churches. This is the largest group of American Christians ever to visit the Soviet Union. There were a group of 19 Soviet Christians that visited the United States in May. I was privileged to meet with four of those people, to have dinner in a small group with two of them. Our mission was first and primarily to witness to the unity that we have in Jesus Christ. An interesting statistic, which most of you heard, many of you heard yesterday. In a country of 275 million people in the Soviet Union, there are between 40 and 60 million active worshiping Christians, another 45 million Muslims, about 2 million Jews. Where there are 40 to 60 million active worshiping Christians, there are only 18 million members of the Communist Party. I think these are some facts that many of us find startling, at least I did. Our second mission was to witness to our common hopes for peace, to raise questions, to express concern, and to learn. I am not an expert on the Soviet Union or on the arms race or arms control. I have made it an area of interest for about the last 8 years. I've read a lot. I have impressions from having been there, but I certainly don't have all the answers, and I guess probably nobody does, but I'll share with you some of my impressions and then have time for questions. The first thing I want to do is talk about human rights. When we think of human rights, what sort of things do we think of? Just shout them out. Express your own opinion, okay? Four freedoms, which are? Freedom from want. Is that one of our human rights? Four freedoms? Okay. Freedom from persecution. Okay, essentially, when we think of human rights, we think of freedom from, right? Freedom from government interference in our lives. And this arises out of our revolutionary history, I think, back in the 1770s, when we felt oppressed or persecuted or unjustly under the thumb of England and wanted freedom from government interference, an absentee government. Our concern was not so much for economic concerns, because as far as we knew, we didn't even know where our western borders were. There was always more land out there, rich in natural resources. Our concern was freedom from government. The Soviet revolutionary history was to some extent also a concern for freedom from tyranny under the czars, but first it was concern for economics. millions of people between about 1905 and the 1917 revolution, and more for a few years after that, were starving to death. And the primary thing that the people of, at that time, Russia, wanted was to make sure they weren't going to starve to death. And so when they think of human rights, they think of guarantees by the government of what the government will provide. And they would include free medical care for all, free education for all through university, though not everybody can go to university, you have to qualify academically. But if you qualify, as I mentioned yesterday, free tuition, free room and board in college, and you even get living expenses. So most college students don't work. They just concentrate on their studies. Well, I mean, if you know what I mean. Freedom, let's see, guaranteed employment. I really believe that there is not unemployment in the Soviet Union. That's not without being a mixed bag either, because they're very inefficient, and I suppose they can afford to be because everybody's working. I showed a slide yesterday, not a very good one, of the Moscow subway, which is really second to none in the world. It is incredibly efficient and fast and clean, has 6 or 7 million riders a day in a city of 8 million people. And it costs 7 cents to ride all day. And then at night, little old women come out and sweep the subway with brooms made out of sticks and mops. And, you know, in the United States, we'd have these great, well, if we bother to clean our subways, I don't know if they do, but we, you know, I'm sure we would have great big Zamboni-like machines. By guaranteeing employment, they don't need to be very efficient. And also, we talked with a young man, you know, no, not an official person, a man about 25 years old, and I asked him, I said, what's the price of no poverty in the Soviet Union? Because, you know, as far as we could tell, that there was no abject poverty. And I think that's probably true. Of course, we didn't see the whole country. And he said, well, if you don't work, the government will support you for a few months, maybe 4 or 5 months. If you still don't work, then they put you in that jail over there. So, every time we would raise questions of human rights, instead of answering our questions, they would say, we don't have anybody sleeping in the subways, which is true. They didn't have anybody sleeping in the subways. We don't have 9.5 million people unemployed and things like that. The Helsinki Accords on human rights include these both of these categories. And the technical name for them, what we think of as human rights, are called procedural human rights. And what the people in the Eastern Bloc countries think of human rights are called substantive human rights. It would be my personal hope that all countries in the world would guarantee both types of human rights. But that was very interesting, something that I learned in my reading and my study before the trip, that there's more to human rights than just what we think of. Now, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying that we're at an equivalent situation. Personally, I'll take our human rights over their human rights, but I did want to raise that difference. We raised, contrary to the bad press that we got upon our return, we constantly raised questions of human rights. When we asked about Sakharov in one meeting, the head of the Soviet Peace Committee. Now they have, I can't really explain peace committees because though they were explained to me many times, I never quite got the picture. They are ostensibly not government committees. They are financed by voluntary contributions from individuals and from businesses to further the cause of peace inside the Soviet Union and around the world. It seemed to us that they were straight PR organizations for the Communist Party. At least we got, with one exception, straight answer, straight Communist Party line every single time from the Peace Committee, which was very frustrating because I felt that, most of us who were there had a fairly balanced picture that the United States is at fault to some extent in regard to the arms race, at least, and the Soviet Union is at fault to some extent, and we didn't get that. I'll get into that in a little bit more. But so this head of the Soviet Peace Committee, when asked about Sakharov, and I'll use my notes now so I can get it as close as possible, said, and this was when, at the time when there still had not been any official word or any pictures of Sakharov, when people in the West really didn't know what his condition was. And this man answered, "Sakharov is not a simple person. Any society might be proud of its outstanding physicists, and that's what Sakharov used to be. But in any society, a conflict may arise between one person and a society." And then he went on to say that, I couldn't keep up in my writing, that Sakharov used to be a brilliant scientist, and now he's really just sort of a nut. He says, "I believe," then he went on to criticize the Western press. He says, "I believe it is the responsibility of the religious establishment to stop the press from speculating about a person's death," because the Western press was reporting that Sakharov had died. And he was saying, what a terrible thing to fool with a person's life like that and report that he's dead. And I wanted to say, I couldn't get in, but I wanted to say, if you want to stop that, just show us Sakharov, and no one will say that he's dead if you can prove to us that he's not. Then he said, "The Soviet Peace Committee," of which he was the chairman, "inquired of his health and was told he feels good." Quote. We raised another question. One of our Catholic nuns, who was also a psychiatric nurse, asked about the Soviet use of psychiatry for political purposes. She noted that 1977, and she was reading off a sheet, sort of as I am now, she said, in 1977, and she listed two organizations, which I didn't get down in my notes. Two organizations denounced the Soviet abuse of psychiatry, including the mentioning by names the Soviet psychiatrist Koryatrin. "Do you address these issues, and will you investigate such charges?" And his response was, "Dear sister, I am more than convinced that what you read from your notes are not your thoughts or your convictions. They are from someone else." That didn't really win friends or influence people from any of us. He said, "There are no such problems in our country. I have great trust in our physicians," and he went on and on. "I'm sure, you know, all the doctors I know are wonderful people, and they would not do such things." Well, it is, as many of you, I'm sure, are aware, it's been quite categorically proven that dissidents are often put into mental hospitals and treated really poorly. So, some real concerns for human rights. We tried, when we talked about concerns about peace, to raise the issue that it's hard for us in the United States, that it's impossible for us to separate human rights from peacemaking. And that we really wished that the Soviet Union would be more upfront and do a better job guaranteeing procedural human rights. Do you have any questions about that before we go on to talk specifically about the arms race? Questions or comments? Or is that the fourth freedom? Okay, freedom from fear? Okay, I was quite sure it wasn't freedom from want. No. Okay, freedom from fear. Well, yeah, let me give you a couple of specific examples. My roommate on the trip and I spent an evening with five young people from Leningrad. This was unofficial, and we just people we met. We went up to this young man's apartment. We were going to trade some things we had for some things he had. He gave me this poster here. Can anyone read Russian? Is it Vona here? It says, "Nyet bomba, no war," which I thought was interesting. Probably None of you have seen a Russian peace poster before. I hadn't. As we were going up to his apartment, it was on the third floor, and we walked up, and outside the building, he said, "Do not speak English in the hallways." So we didn't, and after we left, I talked to this young woman, and I said, "Why did he not want us to speak English in the hallways?" I was pretty sure I knew, but I wanted her response. She said, "Well, you know, people, the neighbors might talk, and someone might tell the police." And I said, "Well, what would the police do?" And he said, "Well, they, you know, they might watch, and nobody likes that." And I said, "Well, you know, that really makes me glad to be an American." And she laughed, and she said, "Oh, what do you mean by that?" I said, "Well, because that wouldn't happen in our country." And she didn't believe me. And she said, "Oh, we know that before all American visitors come to the United States, that the CIA asks them to be spies." And I said, "Gee, the CIA didn't ask me to be a spy." And she smiled and said, "Maybe that's because you wouldn't be a good spy." Which, you know, maybe she's right. Though let me, as an aside, let me say that generally, I think the Soviets knew more about our society than Americans know about Soviet society. These couple of young men in their 20s had not been to college, knew more about Martin Luther King than most Americans, 98%, I'd say. That was interesting. And many other aspects of our history and our geography. We visited Tbilisi, Georgia, and Yerevan, Armenia, two cities of over 1 million population, which I'd never heard of before I went there, to my embarrassment. That's just an aside. So, freedom from fear. Now, the night before, my roommate had been out with these same people, and the one young man was rather drunk. So he, you know, loose lips sink ships or whatever. He talked, you know, quite freely that night and said, "In my country, I am not free." Said that many times. He said, "People in our country drink," and there's a huge alcoholism problem. He said, "Drink because it is the only time they are free." To me, that's a cause of real sadness, not something we should be gloating about, but something certainly to be concerned about. I don't know if fear is really the right word for the typical person. I personally didn't feel fearful. I felt oppressed. And when our plane took off after we left after 2 weeks, a fair number of people broke out into applause as we left the country. I know my own feeling was I was real glad to leave. Though I had met some wonderful people, we'd been incredibly warmly received by individual people and by churches. It is an oppressive society. Any other questions on human rights?
Did the people you meet encourage a lot further contact with you after you left?
A couple of them did, yeah. I haven't gotten letters back yet. I've written two letters. I would think so, but I don't know. I think there may be trouble with both countries. I know at least during the Vietnam War, I had a friend who was corresponding with, I forget who it was, somebody in North Vietnam, and the CIA was detaining some of his mail and things like that, which doesn't make me too happy either.
Did you get any feelings that we did in maybe just a couple of days staying there and learning that the Russian people themselves were very gawky and looking at you as though they wondered what you're supposed to look like or something, or wondered if that was true, is that American, or because they just stared at you. And they went around, but we didn't get to talk at all. It was just a big mass of people. They just stared and stared at you.
I'd say we probably stared at them more than they stared at us. How long ago was that? Okay, the amount of, my understanding is the amount of American tourism to the Soviet Union has really increased in the last few years. We ran into Americans in all the typical tourist spots all the time, so maybe people are just more used to seeing Americans. Yeah, customs is an unfriendly experience. nothing happened, but I find customs in any country uncomfortable if I don't know the language. And you know, I had an amazing experience statistically. It was about unbelievable. I had a fellow in the Soviet Union try to he opened my camera bag and tried to steal my camera, and crime is very low there. I mean, not only officially, but I'm sure that's the case, because you're quite sure to be quite sure to have punishment. And the criminal justice people say the severity of punishment is not the deterrent so much as the certainty of it. And I think that's being proven in some cases in the United States. But I had a man try to do that, which almost unheard of. And then I happened to leave my camera in the restroom in Boston when we got back, and somebody turned it in. So I don't know. It was a unique experience. Let's go on and talk a little bit about the official people we talked to. I don't know if defensive is the right word, but gave a straight best foot forward. Evading tough questions all the time. Unofficial people we met were much less so. I mentioned this example yesterday of we were leaving one of the seminaries, this young seminary student who had guided a few of us around, he was in his early 20s. He said, the problem is in regard to world affairs is that we, meaning common people of both countries, don't know what our governments are up to. He said, you don't know what your governments are doing in Central America or Africa. I don't know why he mentioned Africa. I guess I don't know what our government's up to today in Africa. And then he looked around and he said, and we don't know what our country's doing in Afghanistan. So that would be an example of not being defensive. But all the official people, it was very frustrating. Only surreptitiously were people critical. Only when they were guaranteed that they would not be identified. For example, we had a couple of our, well, I don't know how many, two that I know of, met with two refuseniks, that is, Jews who had applied to emigrate to Israel. And when they applied to emigrate, they were turned down. They were also lost. They both had very good jobs, husband and wife, lost their jobs, were now working at jobs for about a third or fourth of the salary. And they, of course, were very critical. But nobody was openly critical. And I think you hit on part of the problem is freedom of information. I think my impression was that most people were not so, that their lack of criticism was not due as much to fear as it was to information. And I'll talk about that in a bit here on the arms race, that they didn't know enough to be critical of their own government, because all they got primarily was what the fault of the United States. The Jews is the last thing I did want to mention. I'm glad we got to that as far as human rights. 4 or 5 years ago, 50,000 Jews a year were leaving the Soviet Union. Now the number has been restricted to about 2,500. We asked about that. Their official answer was, all the Jews who wanted to leave have left, and indeed many are applying to come back because they're not finding life in Israel, everything they expected. And we knew that may be the case for a handful of people, but we knew that there were many, many Jews who wanted to emigrate, and that that's still a serious problem. And I would consider that a human right, freedom to leave your country. I would hope so. Okay. You hit the lights, Rich. Do I have to do something? That'll help. I'm hitting number A, letter A. Is something supposed to happen? One more plug up there, okay. This is a war memorial in Leningrad. During our trip, as I mentioned yesterday, we met with many high officials of churches. We met the patriarch, that's the number one guy, the equivalent of the Pope, of the Russian Orthodox Church. We met the patriarch of the Georgian Orthodox Church. We met with the second, excuse me, second in command of the Armenian, I can't wait to hear that on tape. Excuse me, the Armenian Orthodox Church. And we also saw about, dozens of war memorials. And towards the end of our trip, we joked about, well, if you've seen one patriarch, you've seen them all. If you've seen one war memorial, you've seen them all. World War II is like last Tuesday for the people of the Soviet Union. They lost 20 million people. The United States had about 400,000 casualties, virtually all of them soldiers. Half of the 20 million casualties of the Soviet Union were civilians. 1,400 cities and towns were destroyed in the Soviet Union in World War II. The desire, therefore, for peace of the common people is palpable. It is much, much, much stronger than the desire for peace, I think, among the common people of the United States. It also means that we asked several times what people meant by peace, and their answer always was, we mean no war. When people ask me questions of peace, I like to think of peace and justice. There is no peace without justice, but their concern was, we don't want violence, we don't want conflict, don't nuke us. That's what they mean by peace. This is in the subway, and I could stand under that seated fellow's outstretched hand. It's a large sculpture, and I need to, a friend of mine took a picture of me under there. I need to get a copy of that so you can see the size of that statue, again glorifying the stopping of the Nazis in World War II, which the Soviets are very proud of. This is the one of the cemeteries in Leningrad. Leningrad had from World War II, Leningrad had a pre-war population of 3 million, one-third of which died in the war. 600,000 people died of starvation in the 900-day siege, and a little over 400,000 died soldiers at the front, which the Nazis were finally stopped about 20 miles outside the city. They mass graves here, 18 to 20,000 people in each of these mounded graves, unidentified, of course. These were starvation victims. The previous picture, I guess we really don't go backwards, it says that we do. Our whole group of 266 of us came to Leningrad and came and we had a short memorial service there. It was a beautiful, beautiful, warm summer June day. There is constantly music playing in the background, very moving music, appropriate for a war memorial. And it seemed to me like a day for living. And there were so many of us that I had a hard time getting in the mood of it, but my feeling was, you know, this is a day for living, and my prayer was that such horror will not happen again. It's interesting that a typical thing at a wedding in the Soviet Union is to go from the wedding straight to one of the war memorials and the bride and groom lay flowers there. We saw that happen many times during our 2 weeks. Still in Leningrad. We were privileged to meet with many different officials. This seated gentleman is the equivalent of the governor of the Republic of Armenia. Armenia is one of the 15 republics or states of the Soviet Union. The fellow standing up is our Armenian interpreter. The Armenians speak Armenian. Russian is only a secondary language for them, so we had to get a special interpreter at this point. And we raised all sorts of questions. From this gentleman and many others, when we would raise questions about the arms race, they would tick off several responses. The first is, well, we have offered since 1978 to negotiate a mutual nuclear weapons freeze. The U.S. has not agreed to do that. We have unilaterally declared to the United Nations that we will not use nuclear weapons first. It is NATO policy to go to limited nuclear weapons, strategic nuclear weapons, in case of war in Europe. So the United States will not declare no first use. We have offered to sign a treaty banning weapons in outer space. President Reagan wants to go ahead with the Star Wars deployment. And it seems like everybody knew that, whether it was seminary students or priests or a Catholic priest or Orthodox priest or government officials, people would just tick that off, just bing, bing, bing. And we really didn't have any straight response to that because those things are all true. We would raise questions of you know, that both countries are say that they're only building nuclear weapons for deterrence, and that the scientists have generally agreed that you only need somewhere between 100 and, say, at the very most, 1,000 nuclear weapons to have to assure destruction of the other country. So why does each side with 25,000 nuclear weapons each continue to build 3 to 5 weapons a day? When we asked questions like that and the human rights questions that I said, we'd really got straight Communist Party line all the time. I raised a question of the Peace Committee in Armenia about, as I phrased it, Soviet intervention in the internal affairs of Afghanistan and Poland. I thought that was pretty straight out. And it was really funny because there was a group of about eight people, and they looked at each other sort of like to tell the truth, you know, which is the real one, who was going to answer the question. And the interpreters switched, and the other interpreter decided to take it, and then somebody finally answered and said, well, we don't believe that there is any Soviet intervention in Afghanistan or Poland. And their response on Poland was that, well, we really don't have any troops there, and we think the Polish army can handle it themselves. And the problem really was precipitated by the West, because you, against Polish law, you sent materials and machines to Poland and precipitated a crisis there. And in Afghanistan, they said the legitimate Afghan government asked for our help 8 times before we finally came in with our soldiers. And the only reason we did is because there were so many guerrillas coming in, financed through Pakistan by U.S. dollars, starting the civil war, that we had to come in to help the legitimate government. So the fault really is the fault of the West. There may be some truth to that. It's difficult to tell, but certainly was very frustrating. And the longer we went at it, the more hopeless I felt when dealing with the officials of the government, that from their perspective, all the fault was on our side. With one exception, when we asked the chairman of the Soviet Peace Committee about Afghanistan, he gave some of that same stuff that I just said, and then he said, And you have to remember that we share a 2,000-mile-long border with Afghanistan. Now, I need to check that. I don't think that 2,000 miles is right. It may be 2,000 kilometers. It seems too big. At any rate, they share a border with Afghanistan. And he said, it simply is unacceptable to have a pro-American government in Afghanistan. And that was the only straight answer we ever got, that it was a matter of political practicality. We're not going to allow a pro-American government on our border. And I just about cheered for that straight answer. I also had to think about what the United States might do if a communist government took over in Mexico, and what our answers, even if they're elected, I don't know. It's something to think about. I'll try to explain what these are. If you can't really see them too well, this was on the side of a building in the Republic of Georgia, and there were three of these panels, each with three political cartoons on them. And the one in the upper left-hand corner shows Reagan, sort of a farmer Uncle Sam, and he has the leaders of the Western European nations in yokes made out of missiles with padlocks with American dollars on them. And the upper right shows Reagan, again, the rancher there, has lassoed all the Western European leaders, and they have rockets on their backs. And down in the bottom, I don't know what the word on the left says. The word on the right is Europa, Europe, and I can read that because Russian is very close to seminary, is close to Greek, which meant that I could find my way around the Moscow subway thanks to my seminary Greek. I knew someday it would come in handy. So, you know, the obvious gist of this is Reagan has tricked the Europeans into allowing the cruise and Pershing missiles into Western Europe. That was an issue that we heard all the time. They're very, very concerned about that, the fact that nuclear missiles can now reach Soviet territory within 6 to 7 minutes. That was it's a big concern. It was in their news all the time while we were there. My response upon seeing this was one of incredible sadness and nervousness. It made my stomach hurt. And not that I'm not critical of Reagan. For those of you here a couple nights ago, you know that I am. But I found it real different for me to be critical of him and for them to be critical of him. This is a sort of political cartoon, I think, that we might see perhaps in American newspapers, but the next day you would see a cartoon making fun of Chernenko or Tip O'Neill or, you know, somebody else and in support of Reagan, and knowing that they were only getting one side really stirred up feelings of nationalism within me, which I was disappointed at because I think nationalism is a pretty dangerous thing, but at any rate, it was pretty interesting to see Soviet political cartoons. We were there on one of our first days. I thought this was an interesting slogan inside, live and let live. The deputy ambassador, Warren Zimmerman, met with us and spoke about 15 minutes on his understanding of the arms race at the moment. And then he answered questions from our group for about an hour. And the answers we got from him were straight administration line, with one exception. And the one exception was, he said, I think that our strong anti-Soviet rhetoric the first couple of years Reagan was in office was a mistake, but we learned from our mistakes, we're changing our rhetoric. But other than that, everything we got from him was the entire fault of the arms race rests with the Soviets. It was very discouraging. I guess I expected that from the Soviets. I had hoped for something a little different from the representatives of a free nation, some acknowledgement of our own fault, at least in previous administrations, if not in the current one. Yet, while many of the people on our trip were very angry about that, saying, gosh, we just got straight party line and no acknowledgement of any fault on the United States. I shared some of that, but at the same time, I was really glad to be an American because we asked these tough questions of our deputy ambassador. And there's no way that Soviet citizens are going to ask their deputy ambassador questions or make comments critical of their government. So it was kind of a mixed bag. Generally, my feeling in dealing with any official from either side was that of hopelessness, and in dealing with the common people was that of great hope, because the people were so warm towards us and so desirous of peace. As I mentioned, I was real glad to leave the Soviet Union, but I made friends with some people there. And while I'm very critical of the society, the bottom line for me was that we saw nothing that was deserving of being destroyed militarily. And as I mentioned two nights ago, I guess after the Ruth Youngdahl thing, that personally, as a Christian, if I'm going to deal with Jesus and call Jesus Lord of my life, that the conclusion I've come to from reading the New Testament is that I'm willing to die for the freedoms that we enjoy. I cannot, as a Christian, participate in killing for that. People of the Soviet Union are people. We saw a lot of skateboarders. These are the young people that we spent the evening with. Millions and millions of sisters and brothers in Christ in that country that our missiles are aimed at. Granted, their missiles are aimed at us. Jesus calls us to love our enemies. When we think that millions of our enemies look like these two little kids, maybe that makes it easier. Yeah, their answer was that we're just supplying aid to people who ask for help. Central America is a whole other issue, which I would say goes back to the peace and justice, the justice aspect of peace. I think the United States has blown it over the last 50 years. Had we worked harder to make justice in those countries, the Soviets wouldn't have an opening to be in there. I'll give a little political commentary. My feeling is that communism is a parasite that feeds on a weakened body politic. And the most effective way that we as Americans can fight communism around the world is to build up the body politic and to make sure that countries that are our allies enjoy the freedoms that we espouse. Freedom to vote, freedom to worship, freedom to economic access. And I think that, now this is personal opinion here, that the U.S. behavior in Central America over the last several decades has been disastrous, and we're reaping the fruit of the seeds that we've sown by propping up these right-wing dictators. I think had we been more concerned with exporting our ideals to these countries rather than importing their products, I wish we could have done both, there wouldn't be any Cubans or any Soviets anywhere in Central America. That's my own feeling. I'm certainly not saying they're not at fault. I'm saying that we've asked for it, and now we've got a real problem from both sides. Not always. Like this young man, when he got a little liquor in him, expressed himself pretty freely. But that was the number one thing for me. I'm very critical of American foreign policy, whether it's this administration or the Carter administration. It's easy to be critical, maybe, but I tell you, I really appreciate the opportunity to be critical, and I'm willing to die for that, I think, militarily. I didn't see anything that... No, what I meant was that I don't think we should nuke the Soviet Union. That's what I meant. Well, I hope so. Sometimes I wonder. Yeah, that's what I meant. Now, certainly, we didn't get close to any military things. That goes without saying, too, I guess. They don't get anywhere near ours either when they visit our country. But no, I'm saying that as critical as I am of their form of government, I don't think the way to counteract it is militarily, my personal opinion. Yeah, sure. Right. But their answer would be, okay, leave Europe out of it. We're just saying we don't have missiles 6 minutes away from the United States. Yes, we do have our tanks along the border and all that stuff, but they would shift the discussion and say, well, let's talk about USSR. Well, probably. I mean, okay, that would be your opinion. We're all talking opinions here, I guess. That did remind me of one thing I wanted to say was World War II is so real to these people that they are, even any common person we talk to is just wants military security at any cost. And those people in the United States who think we're going to outspend the Soviets, I think are sorely mistaken. They are willing to put up with any sort of privation to feel like they're keeping up with the United States. I mean, they're already doing it. I mean, we're not willing to give up our third car. We're willing to raise the deficit to the ceiling and let our, you know, grandchildren pay for it. But whatever it takes to keep up with us, I'm convinced they're going to, because they feel, you know, that they need to do that, and they're not going to be in a situation like they were against Germany. So,
you know, we all agree that the Soviet Union suffered greater losses in World War II than we did. Therefore, they were fighting a war of retribution, more than a war by dealing with the United States was. And so when the Soviet Union thinks of the same people that inflicted such damage on their country, being hand in hand with Americans with nuclear missiles a few miles away, that's where their paranoia comes from. Because they, after the war ended in Germany, the Soviet Union and the Allies felt that they're having Germany in very different ways, we all well know. And the Soviet Union generally accuses the Americans of allowing the fascists to come back into power and us Germans. Say that those are the people that with the American military had their fingers on the button, and I think that's part of the fear here.
Jim has recently returned from how many years in West Germany? 7 years, so that's wherever you speak. Okay, last one here. No, it was a part of continuing exchange since 1956. Yeah, they've also been coming here since 56, though in smaller numbers. There's a group of 19 who came in May. Yes, and I think that's regrettable, and I think the more exchange we can get and the more face-to-face.
What's the roadblock for that? Is it money?
Yeah, I don't think the issue is money. I think it's just being allowed by the Soviet government. The Soviet churches have more money than they're allowed to spend. So that's really not an issue for them, as amazing as that seems. Okay, thank you. One last thing I didn't want to mention, I'd forgotten, is another thing they would raise is that no one in the Soviet Union is making money off the arms race because of their socialist system versus our capitalist system. They would say, our factory manager doesn't care whether he makes tanks or tractors. It's the same to him. And I think there's some legitimate criticism there that part of the problem, this may raise some things. We need to break for supper, and I can talk to people individually. Thank you.